the following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs. Will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Surrounded by big water. Just how stupid is he? Very. Oceans make him dizzy, and with tweets he's busy. So for Trump's edification, Puerto Rico's in our nation.
Everybody sing.
Puerto Rico's in America. Everyone knows it's America. So tell that schmo in America, Puerto Rico's in America. Trump is insulting their mayors as well as NFL players. To get more attention, we'd make him see if athletes in San Juan would take a knee. Puerto Ricans are American, and there is nothing more racist than thinking that people whose skin is tan don't deserve help as Americans. Yeah, I went there. Trump on his visit was touting smack. It's your fault the budget is out of whack. Calling them lazy, he whines and howls. Then he assaults them with paper towels. Oy, what an idiot! This self-congratulatory schmuck, praising himself and passing the buck, raving about their amazing luck, till we all want to say, what the? Puerto Rico's in America. Everyone knows it's America. So tell that schmo in America, Puerto Rico's in America.
Yes, the latest from Lauren Mayer, Puerto Rico's in America, or as the dolt in the White House says.
We are also praying for the people of Puerto Rico.
Unbelievable.
We love Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico. And we also love Puerto Rico.
Yeah, you know, there was a Hispanic Heritage Month event at the White House today, and Donald Trump has to mock the way, you know, native Spanish speakers say Puerto Rico. That's your president for you. Mm-hmm. Hey, you know what today is? It's a big anniversary. 1 year ago today.
I did try and fuck her. She was married.
Huge news there.
I moved in her like a bitch, but I couldn't get there. And she was married. And all of a sudden, I see her. She's now got the big phony tits and everything. I better use some Tic Tacs just in case I start kissing her. You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet.
Yeah.
I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the pussy. I can do anything.
That was 1 year ago today that, well, that we first heard those infamous words, grab him by the pussy. Yeah, there's your president for you. The Access Hollywood tape dropped, as they say, a year ago today. Doesn't it seem like it was so much longer ago than that? Because it seems like we've been living with this guy forever, because a week, it feels like a month or more. A year feels like an eternity. But yeah, in honor of the Access Hollywood tape day, grab 'em by the pussy day, the Trump administration today made some changes to the birth control mandate in Obamacare. Yeah, the new rules allow any employer or insurer to stop covering contraceptive services if they have religious beliefs or, quote, moral convictions against covering birth control. What is wrong with these people? You know, the birth control pill, by the way, is used for much more than just birth control. It's used for endometriosis. It's used for mood swings. It's used for acne. It's used for ovarian cysts. It's used for health care. It's health care for women. And these people, and it's not only religion. It's a moral conviction. Your employer, if they, you know, think it's costing them too much, can say, I don't want to cover mandated birth control, and they're off the hook. Now, I believe that birth control, your health control, your health care shouldn't be, you know, your employer's responsibility regardless. But, you know, that's me. Yeah. By the way, NARAL tweeted out, birth control can cost up to $1,000 out of pocket. Trump's new rule will hit low-income women and women of color the hardest. Of course it will, because that's who they like to target the most. By the way, the ACLU is already suing to block these new rules, so that's good news. Just despicable, absolutely despicable. But so is just about everything this man does. I know this is going to be mentioned in What's News. But last night, Donald Trump had a dinner with some of the biggest honchos, if you will, in the military at the White House. And as they're doing the photo op, you've heard this already, he made this remark.
Do you guys know what this represents?
Tell us, sir.
Maybe it's the calm before the storm.
What's the storm?
Could be
the calm before the storm.
We have the world's great military people in this room, I will tell you that. And we're going to have a great evening. Thank you all for coming. Thank you.
What storm, Mr. President?
You'll find out. Yeah.
What storm? Right?
Thank you.
So he thinks he's still on a TV show. You'll find out. Stay tuned. It's coming up after the break. And today, as he was signed some proclamation or something in honor of National Manufacturing Month or Day or something. And he was asked again.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Mr.
Thank
President, you. What did you mean by calm before the storm yesterday? What did you mean by that?
Thank you very much. You'll find out.
We'll find out.
You'll find out. you know, the question is was there anything to find out? I was watching Stephanie Ruhle this morning, and she had Jonathan Swan of Axios on her show, and they had an interesting back and forth about it.
How do you interpret the calm before the storm? I mean, clearly this is part of the president's love for drama and reality TV. I mean, primetime TV straight out of The Apprentice. Tune in tomorrow.
Well, obviously, I don't have any insight into what classified military actions may or may not being contemplated, but I think there's a high degree of probability that he is trolling everyone.
Trolling everyone.
In fact, I was talking to a senior official last night, somebody who I should stress is not on the NSC, who would not be privy to any covert operations, and they started laughing, saying, don't you get it, he's just trolling all of you. But of course, it's trolling with very serious consequences. This is what he does with national security. I mean,
this is what he does with everything.
It's a different context, but we reported last week private meeting inside the Oval Office discussing the South Korean trade deal, and he says to Robert Lighthizer, his chief trade negotiator, you tell them I'm so crazy I could pull out any minute. And that seems to be the sort of madman kind of approach that he's taking with North Korea, the sort of Nixonian, you know, make these wild statements, these very destabilizing statements, and sort of let the chips fall where they may. Obviously there are risks to that kind of conduct.
You think there are, he's playing with people's lives. He's playing with fire, literal, with nuclear weapons here. And he thinks it's a game. He thinks it's a TV show, and he's teasing to the next commercial break. He's a dangerous, dangerous man. And I just hope we're not the, you know, the casualties in his sick little game. We got a good show for you today. Stephanie Kelton is here, and Stephanie Kelton is an economist. She worked with Bernie Sanders as the chief economist for the Senate Finance Committee when he was the chairman, and she's a professor of public policy and economics at State University of New York at Stony Brook. And usually, if we're talking economics, that my eyes roll back in my head. So believe me, this is going to be a discussion that is brought down to my level, so anybody can understand it. But Stephanie Kelton is a proponent of modern monetary theory. And basically, she's saying, you know, if Medicare for all, tuition-free college, those things are all possible. And don't believe what the Republicans are telling us about the deficit and the debt, because none of it matters. Well, not that none of it matters. I'll have her explain it. All that is coming up with Stephanie Kelton after we look at today's news.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
A group of senior military leaders joined the president at the White House for dinner Thursday night. At a photo op, Trump issued an eerie warning.
Do you guys know what this represents?
What? Tell us, sir.
Maybe it's the calm before the storm.
What's the storm?
Could be the calm. The calm before the storm.
What storm is
we have the world's great military people in this room. I will tell you that. And we're going to have a great evening. Thank you all for coming.
What storm, Mr. President?
You'll find out.
He offered no explanation, but a White House transcript of a speech he delivered to the group shows that he said, quote, "Recently, we have had challenges that we really should have taken care of a long time ago, like North Korea, Iran, Afghanistan, ISIS, and the revisionist powers that threaten our interests all around the world. Tremendous progress has been made with respect to ISIS, and I guess the media is going to be finding out about that over the next short period of time," end quote. The Nobel Peace Prize for 2017 has been awarded to the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, a coalition of non-governmental organizations from more than 100 countries around the world. Announcing the decision at a press conference in Oslo, the chair of the Nobel Committee said ICAN was a driving force in efforts to stigmatize, prohibit, and eliminate nuclear weapons, and that the group was receiving the award for its work to draw attention to the catastrophic humanitarian consequences of any use of nuclear weapons and for its groundbreaking efforts to achieve a treaty-based prohibition of such weapons. Meanwhile, here at home, Donald Trump is expected to decertify the Iran nuclear deal. He declared at the UN General Assembly 2 weeks ago that the agreement was, quote, embarrassing to the U.S., and that he had made up his mind what to do about it.
The word decertify, what does that even mean?
That means that he's not completely scrapping the deal. He's throwing it in Congress's court right now, and he says, I don't like it the way it's written. I don't want to recertify it because every so often it does have to be recertified. I believe there was an October 15 yes. deadline. And what he's saying is that you better find a way to make this deal better.
We must not allow Iran to obtain nuclear weapons. The Iranian regime supports terrorism and exports violence, bloodshed, and chaos across the Middle East. That is why we must put an end to Iran's continued aggression and nuclear ambitions. They have not lived up to the spirit of their agreement, and we will be discussing that tonight.
The administration is reportedly looking for ways to claim Iran is in violation of the spirit of the accord, even if it has complied with its inspection criteria. The IAEA says it is in compliance. If Trump did violate the terms of the deal by reimposing sanctions, it would free Iran to begin producing uranium and reprocessing plutonium immediately. Under the deal, Iran is prohibited from that production for 13 years. The reason that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis have opposed leaving the accord. Trump is expected to announce his strategy in a speech next week. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said the president is open to considering legislation that would ban bump stocks, the gun accessory that enables a semi-automatic rifle to fire faster.
Right now, our focus, as we've said over the last couple of days, has been on healing and uniting the country. The investigation still continues to be in very early stages. We know that both members of both parties and multiple organizations are planning to take a look at bump stocks and related devices. We certainly welcome that, would like to be part of that conversation, and we would like to see a clear understanding of the facts, and we'd like to see input from the victims' families, from law enforcement, from policymakers, and we're expecting hearings and other important fact-finding efforts on that, and we want to be part of that discussion. We're certainly open to that moving forward.
Can you tell us anything about the president's thinking?
I said we're certainly open to that moving forward, but we want to be part of that conversation as it takes place in the coming days and weeks.
Speaker Paul Ryan opening the door, too.
John Cornyn has said he wants to have hearings on bump stocks, yeah. Open to a vote. Are you open to a vote on bump stocks?
Yeah, look, I didn't even know what they were until this week, and I'm an avid sportsman. So I think we're quickly coming up to speed with what this is. Fully automatic weapons have been banned for a long time. Apparently, this allows you to take a semi-automatic, turn it into fully automatic. So clearly, that's something we need to look into.
From the GOP hypocrisy files comes this story about soon-to-be former Congressman Tim Murphy from MSNBC's Chris Hayes.
Pennsylvania Republican Tim Murphy, a congressman staunchly against abortion rights, reportedly urged a woman he was having an affair with to have an abortion. An hour after that report, the House voted on a bill to restrict abortion rights, making abortions after 20 weeks illegal in every state. This bill likely won't have enough votes to pass the Senate. Nevertheless, clear muster at the Supreme Court. But Republicans applauded in the chamber as it passed the House. And among those voting in favor of restricting abortion rights was Congressman Tim Murphy. Yesterday, Murphy announced he would be retiring at the end of his term. Today, House Speaker Paul Ryan announced that Murphy would be resigning a lot sooner than that. His last day is now October 21st.
And that's a bit of What's News for Now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider a contribution. Our work is 100% listener supported. You can find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate. All right, for a little bit more of what's in the news, we turn to our friends at the Talk Media News Service. They're at TalkMediaNews.com, and Doug Christian is on the line. Hey, Doug.
Hi, Nicole. How you doing?
I'm hanging in there. You know, someone in the chat room, Moontruth, just said, if this is the calm before the storm, we better appreciate every day more than ever. What I say is if this is the calm before the storm, we're really screwed because there's nothing calm about what's going on now.
Oh, it's crazy. I loved your report. You summed up, I mean, the hypocrisy, the blatant hypocrisy of the men in the Senate, in the House, that was, who vote against women's reproductive rights and then urge privately something completely different.
Right. Well, and
it's
that's
amazing.
Yeah, and that's what goes on every day. You know, the other weird, I guess it's sort of ironic in that today is the anniversary of the Access Hollywood tape, you know, the grab 'em by the pussy tape. And today is the day that Donald Trump and I guess the men in his administration decided that that insurers and employers don't have to cover women's contraception.
It's so sad. It's so astonishing. I really, I urge young women to remember that if don't stand up for your rights, then they're going to be taken away by people, and it's really important.
You got that right.
That
you got that
really
right.
Remember what it was like.
Yep. So, Doug. Before. What else is going on? I haven't really in my What's News reports. I don't go into much detail on the Russian investigation because, frankly, it's so complicated. And to get it into a concise little package so I can fit it into my reports is really difficult. But last night we learned that Christopher Steele, the dossier, that infamous dossier, is back in the news again. And the guy who wrote it, a former member of British intelligence, was interviewed MI6 was interviewed by Robert Mueller. What more do we know about this?
Well, this is very interesting because, of course, Christopher Steele is highly regarded in the intelligence community. And clearly what has happened is that his dossier linger on the more salacious aspect of this, but forget that for now. Just look at the actual, the root, the nub of the matter, which is, was the Trump campaign, colluding with the Russians, and how extensive was the Russian interference in the 2016 campaign? And clearly, Bob Mueller's office wants to find out who Christopher Steele's contacts were, so that he can put forward a case that is provable within a court of law. And so, it's a very sensitive matter. And clearly, both the Senate Intel Committee and Mueller's team, they don't want to step on each other's toes. So Christopher Steele is not speaking with the Senate right now. He's just speaking with Bob Mueller, which I think is the right strategy.
Yeah, and, well, Mueller's the one who can file criminal charges. The Senate Intelligence Committee can't.
Exactly. And Bob Mueller is a person that has wide respect from anybody who really is anybody in D.C. Here's a guy who graduated from Princeton. He could have chosen to travel the world and just been an Ivy League graduate and da da da. Instead, he joined the Marines. He caught bullets. It was in Vietnam, a highly unpopular war. And then he went back and again and again, kind of like John McCain.
Right. He was the longest serving FBI director in our country's history. Right. No, he enjoys wide ranging respect, I guess, from everybody except for Donald Trump. But Donald Trump doesn't like anybody who, you know, might be looking into his wrongdoings.
Well, one thing that that supporters of Donald Trump may, I hope, realize eventually is that he is not loyal to any party.
Mm-hmm.
He is only loyal to himself. He was, in fact, a Democrat before he decided to become a Republican. So, I mean, this is crazy that anybody is standing up with him.
Right.
Bob Corker, because he is retiring, is getting more and more vocal about how he actually feels about Donald Trump, saying that a few grown-ups in the room are kind of keeping us from going into chaos, which is a pretty astonishing statement.
Right. Did you hear that, you know, in the wake of Rex Tillerson and Moron Gate, that it was Rex Tillerson, John Mattis. Kelly, and General Mattis, they made sort of a pact that if one of them is out, that they all go?
Yeah. They called it the suicide pact. And clearly, Trump himself is aware of that. Which must irk the hell out of him, because he is a person who likes to at least appear to be in control, and clearly, what these three are saying is, you know, we're doing this not for you, buddy, but we're doing this for the country. And I mean, I would argue, and I think a lot of people would, that Rex Tillerson hasn't been the most effective Secretary of State, but. I mean, he's a lot better than some choices like, let's say, John Bolton or somebody like that. You know?
Without a doubt. There was a rumor being floated that they were talking about Mike Pompeo, the current CIA director, sliding in and taking over as Secretary of State if Trump got rid of Tillerson, because he's already been part of all the briefings and everything, so there wouldn't be that much chaos if he were to take over.
Well, it's kind of crazy because, I mean, Trump is a disruptor, and so one of the things is that, I mean, Mike Pompeo, a guy who let's put it this way, he's actually won some quite a bit of respect within the CIA. I mean,
he's actually
got a good working relationship, with him. So
then leave him there.
Why not? Say what?
Then leave him there.
Exactly. I mean, just leave it alone. I mean, there was a wonderful interview with Foreign Minister Zarif Susan Glasser from Politico did it on the Globe, did this 1-hour interview with him on the Global Politico, And Zarif said, if it's not broken, why do we need to fix it? And he was talking, of course, about the nuclear deal with Iran.
Right.
Another thing that is just insane for us to even tamper with. It's important to remember that North Korea was not developing nuclear weapons until the Bush administration decided that no longer were they going to talk with North Korea, because somehow they felt that North Korea was extorting aid, etc. Well, North Korea turned around and did something much worse, and the same thing could happen with Iran. I mean, we decide again to throw sanctions back at Iran, and they could easily turn around and develop their nuclear program all over again, and really throw the whole region into chaos.
Right.
This is serious. And Zarif, he issued, I mean, it was almost a chilling, although he's not a chilling individual, but he issued almost a chilling threat, which is when he was asked whether or not, what Iran would do if the United States decertified the deal, he said, "I'm not going to tell you. We're gonna just. Oh my gosh! I mean, you don't. You really,
right.
It almost put a.
That's how he does things. The other thing is, when he was a candidate, he said he would defer to his generals. You know, he brings in the best people, only the best people, and he would defer to them on issues of foreign affairs where he was not, admittedly, the expert. Well, he's got his generals, he's got everyone saying, you leave it alone, and he just seems to be snubbing his nose at them all. General Mattis, in a hearing just the other day, told Angus King of Maine, he asked him flat out, should we remain in the Iran deal? Mattis said, yes.
Yeah. Mattis is a very thoughtful person. What he's called Mad Dog is so incorrect. Here's a guy who actually, he's very thoughtful, and he absolutely clearly is saying, no, leave well enough alone.
Right.
But I think that one of the things that Trump does, he's a child in many ways, is that if somebody tells him not to do something, don't put your finger in the plug. The first thing he does is put his finger in the plug.
Yeah.
And, you know.
I know. It's like him looking up at the eclipse without his glasses on. He is that child. One last question, one last story. John Kelly, chief of staff, his phone was hacked. Now it's looking like his phone was hacked while he was still head of Homeland Security. And now they're talking about anybody in the West Wing has to put their personal cell phone or personal devices in a lockbox. Does this mean that Trump is not going to be able to tweet anymore?
Oh, that's a funny question. Of course, Trump is going to do whatever he wants. But, I mean, it is absolutely, it's really scary just what happened with John Kelly. I mean, when his phone was hacked, people in the know, I talked with a person in the know about this, and he said it means that probably his camera was being used by a third party.
Yeah.
His phone was being used as a microphone.
Right.
For secret briefings and within SCIFs, which are secure areas. This is just brutal. And of course, it could be the Russians. It could be...
You always had to put your phone in a lockbox in a SCIF. But in the non-secure areas, I mean, in the Oval Office, that's not a SCIF.
The Oval Office is a SCIF.
Is it? Then
yes, it is.
Then how does Trump get to use his phone in there?
Well, he I don't know. I mean, he can actually leave the Oval Office. I had the privilege many years ago of actually visiting the Oval Office, and it's kind of crazy because it feels more armed and armored when you're there than when
sure.
you see it on a movie set.
I bet.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. The doors are very thick. The windows are very thick. It's not quite as casual.
I hear you. I hear
in
you.
The media.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, it's a question I think about. I mean, he lives above the West Wing, I guess, so he can do it from his toilet in the middle of the night.
He's a child. He'll continue to do whatever he wants. Nobody can stop him unless really the Republicans need to put country before party on this and forget. This is not about Republicans versus Democrats. This is about our country right now.
Yes, and hopefully, more saner minds will prevail. Doug Christian from the Talk Media News Service, talkmedianews.com. Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
All right. Stephanie Kelton is coming up. I promise we'll make economics easy. I'm nervous, like a kid going into school with a big test coming up. We'll talk modern monetary theory and the debt and the deficit and the budget and the tax plan and all that kind of money stuff next.
The powers that be say that the bulk of America's middle-class manufacturing jobs are gone and won't be coming back. High-tech jobs are being outsourced too, as are accountants, lawyers, and some other professional positions. So where does this leave us? Grasping at straws, the most abundant of which are retail jobs. But wait, those aren't jobs, they're jobettes. Part-time, poverty pay, no benefits, lousy schedules, little training, and no advancement opportunity. Most big retail chains treat their employees as nothing but a drain on profits, not an asset to invest in. Salespeople are typically paid only $10 an hour, clerks get only $9.70, and cashiers just $9. Worse, 94% of retailers define full-time work as only 30 hours a week. People can't make ends meet on that, and America can't have a healthy economy without a solid middle class. Yet 15 million people are in retail work now, and it's to be our second biggest source of new jobs for the next decade. Well, shrug the powers that be, the retail giants must compete on low prices, so they have no choice but to keep cutting corners on their workforce. As we say in Texas, bovine excrement. Look at Trader Joe's, where full-time jobs start at $40,000. Or at Costco, where employee retainment is a priority and 98% of managers are promoted from within. Low-price chains that invest directly in workers are reaping industry highs in performance, morale, customer satisfaction, and profits. Bad jobs are not a retail necessity, just a corporate choice. This is Jim Hightower saying, this week, a Retail Justice Alliance has been launched to push America's employers and policymakers to turn retail jobs into good jobs that spread a middle-class standard of living and rebuild our grassroots economy. Learn more at RetailJusticeAlliance.org.
This is a huge, huge issue. And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All right, we are back. I am Nicole Sandler, and I'm thrilled to welcome my next guest back to the show. But I admit that I get nervous when I talk to Stephanie Kelton because I'm one of those people. I never took economics in school. When you start talking about economics and debts and deficits, my eyes sort of glaze over. I'm not the only thing I'm good at with money is spending it. But she's a professor of public policy and economics at SUNY Stony Brook, a former chief economist on the U.S. Senate Budget Committee working with Bernie Sanders. Stephanie Kelton, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
You're a proponent of modern monetary theory. And some people, when I talk about, if I mention MMT, they're right there. They know it. And others are sort of like me. It's like, what? So for people like me whose eyes glaze over at the thought of talking economics, can you explain what MMT is?
Yeah, I mean, let me try to do it in the simplest possible terms, because you're, in a way, you're asking me to boil down roughly two decades of scholarly academic work into kind of a soundbite.
Sure.
It's bigger than that, but I'm going to try to give you a thumbnail.
Okay.
So what MMT is basically a shorthand or a brand name for a type of economics, a school of thought, just like maybe your listeners are familiar with Keynesian theory or Austrian theory, you know, Hayek and Keynes. Well, these are just branches of economics. And MMT is a more modern branch of economics. It's come out in, let's say, the last 20 years or so. And one of the things that MMT does, I think that's important, is to help focus our attention on the type of monetary system that we actually have in the real world today, which is not a gold standard. And so many of the other approaches in economics are built around this old, outmoded, gold standard kind of a monetary system. And what ends up happening is you get questions from people like, let's say, Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. who will say things like, well, you want these big programs. You want to build infrastructure. You want to provide tuition-free college. You want to do this stuff. Where are you going to find the money?
Right.
And you notice the question itself, like the idea that you find the money is very much tied to that old-fashioned gold standard thinking, like, you know, as if we go out in the mines and we have to dig up gold in order to get money in order to spend. So modern monetary theory, or MMT, brings us up to date in the real world, where we have this completely different monetary system. It's not a gold standard. It kind of scares people when they realize that we have this thing called a fiat money system, which allows the government to spend by fiat. That's what the word itself means, to legislate money into existence, to authorize the government to spend without these arbitrary constraints. But, you know, we're trying to tell people that this is, in fact, the system that we have, and we should recognize it, and then we should use it to our benefit and figure out the right policies to do that.
Right. Now you are of last week, you had an editorial in the LA Times, Congress can give every American a pony if it breeds enough ponies. And that was perfect for me, because I could follow along the ponies. And there you went with, you know, the Hillary Clinton book she attributed, you know, to Bernie Sanders wanting to give everyone a pony, which was not what he was promising. But he was saying that we should have Medicare for all, and we should have tuition-free college for kids going into college. And you're saying, absolutely, we can. Now, if you would ask Hillary Clinton or, a number of other Democrats, and frankly, all Republicans, can we do that? Their first question is, well, how are you going to pay for it?
Yeah.
Right? But, mm-hmm. but let me just qualify that. Republicans seem to say that when the Democrats are in power. When Republicans are in power, they don't really say that so much, do they?
It's funny, isn't it? It's just, it's a very convenient political weapon, and both sides deploy it to their advantage at different times. There's no question about that. And because there's so much confusion, I think, out there in the public's mind about, you know, the government's debt and the deficit, it's really hard to get a good conversation going. So both sides are able to use it, you know, to whip the other side when it's to their political advantage to do so, to finger point. And, you know, you have Democrats and people on the left pointing their finger at Republicans and saying, look what you did to the deficit. We left you. Bill Clinton left you budget surpluses, and you wasted them with, you know, two wars and huge tax cuts, and the deficit is your fault. And they use that, right? And then the Republicans come along and they say to the Democrats, look what Obama did with the stimulus or with whatever, and you ran up the national debt and the deficit. So no question, both sides use this when they view it to be politically advantageous.
Right, and I'm going to ask a really stupid question, but again, this stuff is not my expertise. What is the difference between the debt and the deficit?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I don't think most people know what the difference is. They assume both are very bad, though.
Right.
So the difference is the deficit is the thing that we measure over a period of time. So let's say a fiscal year. So from one date to the next date, it's the difference between how much money the government spends into the economy and how much it collects out in the form of taxes. That's the deficit. So, you know, at the height of the Great Recession, the government was running budget deficits on the order of more than $1 trillion a year, a very large relative to, you know, historic norms. And that really scared people, because what in the world with $1 trillion deficits? You know, people, it was like hair on fire. The national debt is the thing that anybody who's been to New York City in Times Square area maybe had walked around at some point past this big billboard that goes tick, 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 and the mm-hmm. numbers go flashing before your eyes in real time. And you watch the size of the national debt grow. It's supposed to be this huge, scary number that's $17, $18, $19 trillion. The national debt is nothing more than a record. Okay, it keeps track of all of the past budget surpluses and deficits that the government has run. And what it really is nothing more than all of the U.S. government bonds. We call them treasury bonds. Investors mm-hmm. hold them. They're held mm-hmm. in pensions. They're in portfolios. They're safe assets to people who buy government securities. And that's what the national debt comprises. It's all of the outstanding treasury bonds. It's the money the government spent into the economy and didn't tax back out. Instead, they let people hold government bonds.
So when we hear about that, for instance, China holds a lot of American debt, mm-hmm. why do we do that? Why would we sell debt to a foreign country?
Well, okay, so I would even maybe go back one step behind and say, why does China hold, or why does Japan hold lots of government securities? Where did they get them? How did they buy them? And the answer is that, you know, the United States runs big trade deficits with China and with Japan. And so while they have their people in factories working and manufacturing, you know, cheap stuff to send to us, we get the goods and services flowing in our direction, and they get U.S. dollars because we're paying them, you know, for those goods and services that they're producing for us. So China's sitting there holding all of these dollars, which you can think of China having a checking account at the Federal Reserve, which is the U.S. bank, right? So China earns dollars by making things and selling them to us. They get to hold their dollars in a checking account at the Fed, but they have an option, as would you and I. We don't have to hold our dollars. We can hold something else instead. We could say, well, you know what? Treasury bonds are a little more attractive because they pay some interest. So I'm going to use my dollars to buy a treasury bond. And that's what China does. So what we do is we take the money out of their checking account at the Fed, and we basically put it into a savings account at the Fed. And it's called a U.S. Treasury bond. And people get very anxious about that and say, oh, my God, it's terrible. China holds all this debt. You know, what happens if one day China decides they no longer want to buy treasuries? And I look at that question and I think, well, what you're really saying is, what happens if somewhere down the road China decides they don't want to make stuff and send it to us to get dollars? Mm-hmm. What if they want to make it and send it to somebody else? Or what if they want to make it and keep it for themselves because that's how they raise the standard of living in their own country, by consuming more, keep more for themselves and don't sell it out to the rest of the world? Then China's going to end up with fewer dollars. And if they have fewer dollars, they're going to have fewer treasuries. So I think there's just a lot of confusion about perceived risks associated with, you know, foreigners holding our debt. What it really boils down to is that as long as we're running trade deficits with the rest of the world, they're going to end up with dollars. And with those dollars, they can choose to buy some treasuries.
Okay. So Stephanie Kelton is with us. Now, yesterday you had another op-ed, this one in the New York Times, and it was titled, "How We Think About the Deficit is Mostly Wrong," a less sexy headline than the one about the ponies, you know, for people like me. But we think about the deficit the way we do because this is what we're told, right? Deficit is bad. And what mm-hmm. you're saying is that deficit is not only not bad, are you saying that it's necessary to spur on a good economy to run a deficit?
Yeah, in the U.S., most of the time, budget deficits are not only perfectly normal, but they can be very useful in terms of, I think I finished off that piece by saying that, you know, if we were doing a better job with policy, we would understand that the deficit can be deployed as a very potent weapon in the fight against inequality and poverty and stagnation and so forth. So when we talk about the budget deficit, I'll try to maybe say it in a way that is as simple as I know how to put it, and I tried to do that in that piece as well. Mm-hmm. So if we say the government's running a deficit, right away a lot of people will say, ooh, that's bad.
Right.
But I say, well, hang on a second. Let's talk about what it means to say the government's running a deficit. So let's suppose the government spends 100, maybe it's 100 billion, 100 into the economy. So they're putting 100 in, but they only tax back out 90. So we record on the government's ledger, their books say minus 10, you have a deficit. You have done deficit spending. And now, isn't that a terrible thing? Well, wait a minute. Somebody out there in the economy now has 10 that they would not have had unless the government had spent in more money than it took back out. So the government's deficit is always matched dollar for dollar right down to the penny by a surplus in some other part of the economy. Now, the question for me is, who gets the surplus? What was the government spending on? Was it doing good, important, productive spending? Was it building, repairing crumbling infrastructure? Was it investing in, you know, tech, in innovation, R&D? Was it putting money into education? Was it investing in the kinds of things that increase our long-term prosperity? Or was it, you know, involved in some boondoggle of some kind or whatever the case may be? So there's good deficit spending and there's bad deficit spending for sure. Tax cuts. The Trump tax cuts are a great example. Mm-hmm. You can definitely blow up the size of the deficit by reducing the amount that you collect, thereby leaving more money in the economy for someone to hold. But if you're doing that and all you're doing is skewing the gains toward those at the very top, then you're just using the deficit to widen inequality and that sort of thing. So there are good deficits, there are bad deficits, but all deficits leave someone else in the economy with more money to hold.
So the new Republican tax plan that they're rolling out, they don't have a bill yet. It's just like a 9-page outline that mm-hmm. they've rolled out. It has major tax cuts for the rich. So to have the wealthiest among us pay less in taxes, but major cuts to the social safety programs like mm-hmm. Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Obviously, that's the bad kind of running up of the deficit.
Well, in a way, you know, of course it's bad. It's totally immoral. It's a disastrous proposal. But all of these offsets, these cuts to these other programs mm-hmm. are, if you ask them, what are you doing? They're paying for it. See, they want to come up with something that's closer to being, quote, paid for so that they know the tax cuts are a huge giveaway to the rich. They know that. And they know that it's not going to generate the kind of growth that they're proposing. And it's going to cost so much economic activity. And the jobs are going to come pouring down. And with all of these new jobs, it's going to become new revenue to the government and all that sort of stuff. They know that's not true. So they're trying to hedge against, well, this is really going to make the deficit go way up. They say, well, we'll just cut spending and that will keep the deficit down. So it's all back to this idea that we're afraid to increase the size of the deficit. I mean, on the one hand, you could say it would be better to just let them get away with the tax cuts and not pay for them than to have them both get away with the tax cuts and then take a hatchet to all of these social programs.
Well, a few weeks ago, they passed a military spending bill, an appropriations bill that increased our military spending by some ungodly amount. It was like a $700 billion bill, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that included an increase in funding, but it wasn't all new, an additional $700 billion over last year. Uh-huh. So it was a $700 billion authorization, but they did, in fact, give more money to the defense budget than even the White House was requesting. They said, oh, we'll give you what you want, but here, just take some extra, you know, just because we're in a good mood today. And you have 89 U.S. senators vote for this legislation without a single concern about the, quote, where is the money coming from? How are we going to pay for it? What's it going to do the deficit? They walked in, they took the vote, they authorized the spending, and now the spending will take place. That's how Congress pays for things. They walk in, they vote for legislation, and they authorize the spending, and it's paid for at that point.
All right, and so I'm a little bit lost. When the top tax rate of this country was around 90%, we were doing well, right? When they lowered it down to 70%, as a nation, we were still doing well. Right now, our tax rates are lower than they've been in history, aren't they? Yet they still want to keep lowering them. What kind of excuse do they use to keep lowering the tax rates, other than it's what their donors want?
Well, they don't tell us that, right? They tell us that the reason for lowering tax rates is to take the shackles off and to unleash the entrepreneurial spirit, to unburden the job creators. And that's the argument that they make, right? You're gonna end up with so much more money in the hands of the people who are the really important people in the economy, the people who make the big investment decisions and the big hiring decisions. And so If you can bring down the burden on those folks, then they're going to turn around and spend into the economy. It's going to benefit everybody. Rising tide lifts all boats, and you know the trickle down argument. They don't put it in crude terms. They sell this stuff. I mean, it's a tremendous marketing pitch that they've got, right? That this is, it's good for you, right? It's not just good for the rich. It's good for all of us.
But the trickle down thing doesn't work. And so throughout history, it's never worked, yet they keep going back to that same argument just because they can.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they can point to certain things. Like they can say, look, we had higher rates of growth. The economy grew faster during the expansion in the Reagan years, as opposed to during the expansion during the Obama years. They can point to that. But, you know, it's extremely unlikely that the kind of tax cuts that they're talking about were responsible for that higher growth. I mean, that's back in the day when we actually had workers who had jobs that had higher wages, wages increased, greater economic security, workers who had pensions, and there are a whole variety of other things that were going on in terms of trade and everything else that gave you a better economy. But what you're saying is exactly right. If you do what the Trump administration is proposing, and you get these massive tax cuts on those at the very top, including the estate tax and all that other stuff, are these people going to say, wow, I feel so much better now because I have all of this additional take-home income. And so now I can go out and I can buy the, you know, I can replace the refrigerator that's been on the fritz. I can take the family on that vacation I've been putting off. These people are consuming everything that they could possibly want to consume and then some. And an additional boost to their income isn't going to spur additional spending. It isn't. They're going to plow it into real estate and financial assets and that sort of thing, because that's what rich people do when they get richer.
Right. So the money doesn't go back into the economy as a way to spur it on.
It
gets squirreled away into those kind of vehicles where we don't see it, where if there was a middle class tax cut or some other way to get money down to the people who actually are living paycheck to paycheck, that gets spent with each pay period.
Absolutely. So the people who've looked at this and who are saying that what the Trump tax cuts would do is to generate, you know, 80% of the benefits go to the top 1% over the course of the next 10 years. If you were to rewrite the tax plan and skew the benefits heavily toward, as you just said, the middle class and people at the bottom, I strongly suspect you would have a major boost to the economy as a result of that. I don't believe that tax cuts don't work. I don't believe that you can't actually improve economic outcomes through cutting taxes. I think it's pretty obvious that you can. I just think it's also obvious that you can't do it by skewing the cuts to those at the very top who aren't going to turn around and spend the income.
Do you see anything in what the outline that they've given us that suggests that there will be tax cuts for the middle class? Because that's what they're saying. That's what Trump is saying. It's like,
Yeah. So they're the people who've looked at this, like the Center for Tax Justice and Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and other Washington wonky think tanks, research centers. It's a little hard because, as you said, we just have a 9-page framework. So we don't really have the guts of the proposal. We don't have the kind of details we need. There are likely, at least from what we can tell, tax cuts for the middle class. Some families will pay slightly less as a result of the tax cuts. But as you heard Congressman Ryan maybe recently when he was asked, can you guarantee that there won't be tax increases on anyone, you know, in the bottom 90% or something? He said he couldn't guarantee that. So the way it looks right now is that some people on the lower end of the income scale will actually see their taxes go up.
Wow.
As a result, but we don't have everything we need to know exactly, you know, what might happen.
You know, I saw a comment from Bob Corker, the senator who actually has announced he's retiring, so he doesn't feel beholden to, you know, towing the party line. But what he said is if he sees there's one dime added to the deficit, he's a no vote. Now, it's good that he's a no vote, but he would be a no vote for the wrong reason.
Yeah, that's my position. I mean, I think you have all you need to say no to the Trump tax cuts, just based on the fact that, A, they won't do what they purport to do, which is to provide this big boost to the economy and have all these benefits that trickle down to everybody else and give us more growth and higher incomes and all that kind of stuff. It's not going to work as advertised. And the other thing it's obviously going to do is exacerbate levels of income and wealth inequality that are already dangerously high in America. And so for those reasons alone, I think you say no to this proposal. But using the deficit to say, well, I can't vote for anything if it ever adds a penny to the deficit is just not, it's the wrong guideline for making a judgment about what's good legislation and bad legislation.
So this is, the whole thing, the deficit, it's not saying the deficit doesn't matter, but how we get to the deficit is what matters, right?
Well, it matters a lot because as I was, saying before, if you think of what the deficit does, the impact on the economy, if we say the government is going to embark on a big, ambitious infrastructure program, it's going to spend $1 trillion or more to repair crumbling infrastructure.
Right.
And it's not going to worry about, raising a dollar of new revenue for every dollar it plans to spend. It's just going to, if it results in a deficit, that's okay. We're not going to worry about that. And you say, okay, well, what's going to happen? A whole bunch of construction workers and engineers and architects and manufacturing, businesses that sell heavy equipment that move stuff around. All of these people are going to start getting paid because they're going to get paid to start fixing and repairing and building out green, whatever we do, And so the deficit matters because it has a real impact on the economy and it has a real effect on people's pocketbooks. It's going to add income into the economy. The question is, for whom and for what purpose? Is it good, useful spending? Or is it, wasteful, unnecessary kind of stuff?
Right. So it's how we get to that deficit that is the determining factor. An infrastructure project, a $1 trillion infrastructure plan, would be great for the economy. Yes, it would add to the deficit, but it would inject so much into the economy that it would pay for itself.
So the deficit is just the number we write down.
Right.
That's all it is. And you see it reported in the news. It's a number in a newspaper. It's a number in an article. It's just the number that we write down. And all it's doing is recording how much more we added to the economy than we subtracted out. It's a good thing.
Right.
It's a good number, right? Because from the perspective of the economy, if you turn your back, if you say, I'm looking this way and I see the deficit and it's $400 billion, but you turn 180 degrees around, what you see is the surplus and it's $180 billion. So it's just that we're so used to looking at the government's budget and that number on their balance sheet, we forget to look at the number on our balance sheet, right? The economy as a whole has its own balance sheet, books, ledger. And so when we talk about the deficit, we are putting numbers on the ledger for the rest of the economy.
So who in Congress, I know Bernie Sanders brought you in to the Senate when he was head of the chairman of the Budget Committee. You were the chief economist working under Bernie. Obviously, Bernie is with you on modern monetary theory. Are there others in Congress who are proponents of this economic theory, or are most of them of the school that says no, we're from the debt and deficit hawk school?
Well, I hope Bernie is with me on this. I can tell you, Congressman Khanna, Ro Khanna. California, he is very openly embracing the arguments and ideas behind MMT. I haven't had an opportunity to go door to door and sit down with all of the different members of the House and Senate. I would be more than happy to do it. I think that what you have right now, as we started off the conversation saying, is just too many politicians using debt and deficit as rhetorical weapons in a never-ending battle, to score a quick point against the other side. I don't think there's much awareness or attempt to understand what these things really are all about.
I hear you. Well, I understand a lot more now, thanks to you. Stephanie Kelton, again, professor of public policy and economics at State University of New York at Stony Brook. I'm going to post links to both your op-ed in yesterday's New York Times and the one from last week in the LA Times, because they're both very easy to understand as well. And it brings a whole different perspective to this argument. Stephanie, thank you so much. It's great to talk with you. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Nicole.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
There you go. I hope that made sense. I get nervous talking to her because I'm in so over my head. And that brings us to the end of a week. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll be back on Tuesday, 3 to 4 Eastern, live at NicoleSandler.com and 6 to 7 Eastern on the Progressive Voices Network. Have a great weekend, everyone.